From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nnamdi Show, connecting you with your neighborhood and the world. There are rivers that once teemed with wildlife, rivers where people could swim, rivers that were full of fish instead of plastic bags and discarded tires. Today, the Potomac, Patuxent, and Anacostia rivers are something else, waters struggling to survive. The Potomac and Patuxent have both received a D grade from environmentalists, and the Anacostia is routinely named as one of the most polluted rivers in the nation. These are frustrating facts for the riverkeepers pushing for their cleanup. Riverkeepers work to educate the public and bring legal action against alleged polluters. In our region, river health is often overshadowed by the problems of the Chesapeake Bay, and the riverkeepers say our local waterways need a lot more attention as the Washington region continues to grow. Joining us with a look at the health of the Potomac, Patuxent, and Anacostia is Fred Tutman, the Patuxent Riverkeeper. Fred Tutman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us is Dottie Younger, the Anacostia Riverkeeper. Dottie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Ed Merrifield is the Potomac Riverkeeper. Ed, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Those of you who'd like to join the conversation can do that by calling 800-433-8850 or by sending an email to kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. Fred, before we talk about the rivers, talk for a moment about the waterkeeper movement and where it comes from.
Well, the waterkeeper movement started on the Hudson River. It was actually an effort by commercial fishermen there to find an advocacy presence to protect their waterway, their livelihood, from incursions from polluters of various kinds. It was a model of citizen activism that became rather successful locally. Huge gains were made, and a movement was formed about 7 or 8 years ago. And chaired by environmental attorney Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., to brand and protect the trademarks of riverkeepers so that other movements similarly could spring up around the country, but they'd have some control, some quality control over the establishment of these separate independent movements.
And the movement is known as the Waterkeeper Alliance?
Yeah, that's the accrediting body, the group that licenses individual waterkeeper programs, but we're all independent.
You're not only independent, it would appear you're also international. This isn't just an American movement. It's my understanding you just got back from an international waterkeepers conference.
We all did. It's actually one of the licensing requirements that we all go and we connect with our brother and sister waterkeepers from all over the planet. About 38-35% in that range of the waterkeepers internationally are international programs, no longer on the continental U.S.
About how many waterkeepers are there?
About 188, 190. We're kind of fluctuating in that area right now, but about that many.
It seems that your job involves both carrots and sticks. On the one hand, you're trying to educate us, the public. On the other hand, you also file lawsuits against alleged polluters. How would you characterize the work that you do?
It is a combination of carrots and sticks. Certainly, wherever you can use carrots to get people and governments and agencies to do the right thing, you do that. And when that doesn't work, then it's time to pull out the stick. I have been I've been known by some of my colleagues. They have said of me, "You have a bully pulpit."
Dangerous Dottie.
Dangerous Dottie. That's going to stick, I'm afraid. Yeah, so we have bully pulpits available to us, when necessary, we can be the bad cop that needs to come in and enforce the law. We have really great environmental laws in this country, and but those environmental laws are only as good as they are enforced, and so it's a combination of sticks and carrots to get them enforced.
Ed Merrifield, how much time do you actually get to spend on the water, and when you're out there, what exactly are you looking for?
Well, one of the first things I learned is that most of the work we do doesn't happen on the water. I would say I get out on an average about once a week. That's about an average time we get out on the water. Some of it's patrolling the areas. Some of it's taking samples of water. It just really depends on the issue at the time.
And you say most of the work you do isn't really on the water. Could you characterize what most of the work you do consists of?
Well, let's see. Just this week I was in Pennsylvania doing a training for those who want to learn about keeping mud on construction sites, I was talking to Montgomery County Department of Public Services. Tomorrow, both Dottie and I will be at a presentation at George Washington University, Policy Greenhouse they're having with the city. So there's a lot that happens, let alone all the work we have to do in making sure that the illegal pollution is stopped as fast as it can be.
Your rivers each have unique issues, but I'd like to talk first about some of the similarities in terms of the challenges that you face. What are the biggest sources of pollution in our local rivers, generally speaking, Fred Tutman?
Well, the Patuxent some people refer to as Chesapeake Bay in miniature because it's got a little bit of all of those slices of the pie. What we call non-point source pollution, which is runoff and degradation from growth, construction, and development, and diffuse sources, is probably the leading source on the Patuxent. Maybe not so in some of the other rivers that have agriculture and other things like that going on. I'd say ag is kind of on the downslope on the Patuxent. We've also got well over 37 wastewater treatment plants on the Patuxent, and these are dischargers that are not compliant. In other words, there are places that process raw sewage, but they're state-run or they're privately run, and they're not operating within their permit guidelines, and so they're polluting. They're adding point source pollution to the waterways.
You mentioned, Dottie Younger, that we have pretty good laws to try to protect our water, but are they really strong enough? Can we talk in more specific terms, say, about the Clean Water Act?
The Clean Water Act is a great example of a really great environmental law. It's a set of tools that can be used to keep our waterways clean, although the goals of the Clean Water Act, the deadline for those goals has come and gone. They were supposed to happen in the mid-1980s, and here we are 20 years later, almost 30 years later, and we still haven't met anywhere near those goals of the Clean Water Act. And so that's one of the things that waterkeepers do is we hold government officials and agencies and polluters accountable to those goals that we are supposed to have already achieved. Our water bodies are already supposed to be fishable and swimmable. We talk about a fishable and swimmable Anacostia. And the goal for that is 2032. It was supposed to be in the 1980s. And so, again, these rules, these laws are only as good as they can be enforced.
Ed Merrifield, the Clean Water Act.
Well, let me just amplify some of that a little bit. In 1972, when the Clean Water Act was enacted, Senator Edmund Muskie stood on the floor and said of the Senate and said that this act means we will no longer be treating our rivers and streams as sewers. And here we are 37 years later still putting 2.5, 3 billion gallons of water in the D.C. area that has raw sewage in it, industrial waste, things right out of our bathrooms. By 1983, we were supposed to have all our rivers and streams in this nation fishable and swimmable. And every one of the four states in the Potomac watershed and D.C. has fish advisories about why we shouldn't be eating the fish because of the pollution that's in the water. And by 1985, we were supposed to have a nation of zero pollution. So I think in some ways I'm still fighting to get us to 1985.
You're still trying to get us to 1985, and we haven't gotten there simply because even though the laws are on the books, they are not seriously enforced?
I think that's true to some extent. The answer to that is basically yes. I mean, it's really the reason we didn't make it is because polluters and friends of polluters worked at stretching out those dates, and of course in some ways we're all polluters, so we're all part of this problem.
Well, Ed, it's my understanding that you are fond of telling people that we are the Potomac River. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we learned in high school that we're mostly water. We're about two-thirds water, and about two-thirds of that water comes from the water that we drink, and the rest of it comes from the water we get from our food. And when you add all that together, we are not only mostly water, we are mostly Potomac River, since we get our water from the Potomac River, and it doesn't matter whether it's from the bottling companies or otherwise, we get our water from the Potomac River, so we are mostly Potomac River.
The Potomac starts all the way out in West Virginia, and the water has a long way to travel before it arrives here in Washington. How does that complicate efforts to clean it up?
A good question. First of all, since all water flows downstream, all those problems we know about upstream, including intersects in the fish that's produced by endocrine disrupting chemicals. We know that all that water is coming by and into our drinking water intakes. So the problems become just as great as that. Government just told us at the end of last year that many of these chemicals that are not tested for by our water suppliers, who do a great job, by the way, of meeting the standards that EPA puts on, but there are so many chemicals we now know are in the water that make it right through our drinking water plants exactly the same way they came in. And when you add that together with what Dr. Robert Lawrence up in Johns Hopkins has said, Johns Hopkins Medical School, we may no longer say that dilution is the solution to pollution. When you put all that together, we have issues that we have to work on in the water down here in our area.
We're talking with three of our region's river keepers about pollution in the Patuxent, Anacostia, and Potomac rivers, and inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Do you have questions about the health of our region's rivers? More importantly, do you have answers? What do you think needs to be done to clean up our region's rivers? 800-433-8850, or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Fred Tutman, the Patuxent, is also, like the Potomac, a long river, the longest river contained within Maryland. Is there any one player along its path who is particularly responsible for its health?
No, there isn't one player. It really is systemic. And people are fond of saying in my watershed that it's all of us. But, you know, I don't equate somebody who's not doing a rain garden or someone who's throwing trash in the river on an individual basis, what I call retail pollution, versus wholesale polluters. There are some bad actors. There are coal-burning power plants. There are, again, non-compliant, privately run facilities. There are profiteers. There are manufacturing plants that are very empowered, and they manage to evade regulation because the government is very eager not to give offense, and they're trying to get along and please all the players. And, you know, clean water is pretty unequivocal. It's either clean or it's not. There's no room for margin. It's a great injustice, Kojo. I think that's what people are overlooking. We're taking wealth, natural resource wealth, from one sector of the population, and we're lining somebody's pockets with it. That's why we're not making gains. It's not expedient for some.
Well, for those of you who don't know it, the Patuxent touches Anne Arundel, Charles, Calvert, Howard, Montgomery, Prince George's, and St. Mary's counties. I've read that the population growth in the Patuxent watershed since 1970 has been more than 136%, and the population will increase by another 20% within the next decade. How can we use that information to prepare for the additional stress, if you will, on the river?
Well, there's some confusion that people have. But first, there's the argument that we're accommodating population. The truth is we're accommodating profits. We're actually putting and allocating population to the most sensitive and vulnerable areas in the region. That's sprawl. We're manipulating scarcity and demand. So we're not accommodating population growth. We're accommodating real estate profit growth, which is a very, very specific thing. If you look at the region and you look at where the growth is and where it isn't, it happens that the investment in growth, the public investment and the focus on growth, is not in those areas that are best equipped to accommodate it.
So when you talk to the executives, the elected officials, the county councils, and all of that list of councils that I just talked about that make up that the Patuxent River runs through, you first have to get past the contributions made to their campaigns by developers. You have to get past the requests being made by residents to live and build there. You have to get past the notion of convenience that so many of us have about living by the river. And then you have to tell us, no.
Well, now you're now you're depressing me. but you're right. I mean, that's what we're trying to overcome. We're also trying to overcome the image of what riverkeepers are as lone guns or somehow lunatic fringe. The truth is we are citizen activists, community advocates, where community is defined by a particular watershed. So part of what we're doing is trying to do culture change one watershed at a time. And people don't want to hear it. They think we're bunny huggers and heron huggers and fish kissers. And, you know, we've been called, I'm sure my colleagues here have been called better names than that.
We have people on the line who want to know a little bit more about you. Here's Sarah in Foggy Bottom in Washington. Sarah, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to know if these were paid positions or whether they do this work as volunteers in addition to their other employment.
Dottie Younger, are you getting rich being a river keeper?
Not rich, but paid.
I am being paid to be the Anacostia River Keeper. It's one of the quality standards. It's one of the requirements of a river keeper program is that there is a full-time paid advocate for that particular water body. And so I am the full-time paid advocate for the Anacostia River.
And you're paid by membership donations or whatever?
We are paid. We have funding from grants and foundations, and we are a membership membership organization, and so members pay dues to our organization. Having the members as part of our organization, that allows us, that's who we represent. That's mm-hmm. we are representing your interests in having a clean, safe river in your water body.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're paid to do it.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call. For those of you who have already called, stay on the line. We have to take a short break. When we get back, we'll get to your calls. We still have a couple of lines open. The number is 800-433-8850. If you have questions or comments about the health of our region's rivers, if the lines are busy, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon, this is WAMU 88.5. I'm Matt Bush.
Hi, it's Kojo Nandi inviting you to take part in an online chat tomorrow afternoon at 1:15. I'll discuss regional politics and the news of the day. Go to conversation.wamu.org and become part of our growing community of public radio fans.
WAMU 88.5 and Olney Theater Center are giving away tickets to three summer shows, Ain't Misbehavin', The Glass Menagerie, and The Millionaires. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar.
In this country, Michael Jackson's ever-lightning skin caused much comment over the years. In other parts of the world, lightning dark skin is big business.
Be the one with Active White Skin. Active White L-glutathione capsules.
How people of color around the world are being sold on the appeal of pale skin. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Homestead Resort in Virginia, an outdoor playground 3 hours from D.C. with recreational packages for the entire family, including golfing, horseback riding, canoeing, and kayaking. More information at thehomestead.com.
Partly cloudy skies throughout the afternoon. The high will get up to 82 degrees. Cloudy skies overnight with a low of 65. Currently, it is 78 degrees in northwest D.C. Now back to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
We're talking with three of our region's river keepers about the state of the Patuxent, Anacostia, and Potomac rivers, and taking your questions or comments at 800-433-8850. Dottie Younger is the Anacostia River Keeper. Fred Tutman is the Patuxent Riverkeeper, and Ed Merrifield is the Potomac Riverkeeper. Speaking of which, let's talk with Gary in Sterling, Virginia. Gary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. This is really an honor and a privilege to speak to y'all waterkeepers. You too, Kojo.
Thank you.
But what I've noticed in that last big rain we had, you know, a week and a half ago, was the Potomac River and the tributaries like out here in Loudoun County, Sugar Land Run, Horsepin Run, Broad Run, Goose Creek, etc., all turned orange. And I noticed the Potomac River turned orange, and then it finally it started turning yellow, and now it's back to a green-blue color. But driving down my neighborhood street, I noticed the houses where they have the grass cut real close and short and where there's a lot of edging done. I've also noticed this at the retail centers and shopping centers, that the grass or the water running off the driveways and the curbs is orange. And I believe, you know, if we just let the grass reseed itself and cut it, you know, 4 or 5 inches high instead of so close and so short, that it would help alleviate, because it would filtrate the water better, it would sequester oxygen, and et cetera. There's a lot of advantages to it. You'd have more lightning bugs.
Here's Ed Merrifield.
Well, he's right. Sediment is the number one pollutant in America. In our area, we'd say sediment and the two nutrient pollutions, nitrogen pollution and phosphorus pollution, are the top three. And we do need to have things that we can do to change this. One of the things that all the riverkeepers in the Chesapeake, our waterkeepers in the Chesapeake, are doing is working on training folks to understand what's coming off of construction sites and how it shouldn't be. The mud that's on construction sites should stay on construction sites. Kojo, if I may just make
Please,
one other point. Fred was talking about noncompliance, and I think all the listeners should understand that the term noncompliance is really another term for committing illegal acts. It is illegal under the Clean Water Act to not be in compliance with your permit, if you will. So people should understand when they hear that word that it has a lot to do with what's illegal and what should be stopped right now.
Gary, thank you for your call. Daddy, one of the biggest problems for the Anacostia is sewage. Every time we get a heavy rain, human sewage overflows into this river. It's my understanding that it's going to cost billions of dollars to fix this problem. Why does this happen? How long will it take to fix?
It happens because in the district we have an antiquated sewer system. It's called the combined sewer overflow system. So what happens when it rains really hard, and I'm talking about a half an inch to an inch, so like it has been for most of the spring and summer, every time it rains hard, all of that excess, all of that water has to go somewhere, and there's so much of it that it overfills Blue Plains water treatment facility, and Blue Plains simply can't handle the volume of the water. And so that water then goes directly into the sewer system and combines with the sewage that is there. Blue Plains is not able to handle that volume of water, so the water goes directly untreated into the Anacostia. So every time in the Anacostia watershed you flush your toilet when it's raining really hard, your raw sewage is going directly into the Anacostia untreated. It's not a pretty sight, but it's the reality of what's happening.
But there's been a lawsuit that focused on this issue, and the D.C. Water and Sewer Authority says what?
There has been a lawsuit, and from that lawsuit has come what's called the Long-Term Control Plan, which is a very expensive, timely plan to put in, basically to build tunnels, metro-sized tunnels under the Anacostia. So when it rains really hard, that overflow water, all that storm water, all that water that's running off all of the impervious surfaces in the district. And in the district, half of the district is impervious surfaces, so surfaces that can't capture that rainwater. All that rainwater would then go into these, would be stored in these tunnels until such time that Blue Plains could handle the volume. It's projected to cost somewhere between $2 billion and $4 billion. It's been mandated by Congress, but no federal funds have been appropriated for it. And so WASA is going to have to find the money, and that's going to mean increases in rates. Until we can build these tunnels. Once they build the tunnels, it'll be able to capture about 98% of all of the stormwater, but it will take years to build.
You mentioned increases in rates. That means increases in the water bills of consumers. Ed talked earlier about the Clean Water Act, and we were supposed to be here in 1980, and we're not here as yet. What happens if residents begin to object to the raising of our water bills? What could we be sitting here 20 years from now and this still hasn't happened? Or does the lawsuit mandate that it's got to happen, or somebody, someplace, pays a penalty?
The money is going to... As Fred was saying, you're gonna have to follow the money. The money has got to come from somewhere, and if the money doesn't come to build the long-term control plan, then it's not going to get built. There are some groups that are advocating for, in the meantime, to be greening the city, so to reduce the amount of impervious surface, to create more pervious surfaces. So if we could capture that rainwater before it hits the Anacostia, once trash or sediment or raw sewage gets into the Anacostia, it is much harder to deal with than it is to keep it out in the first place. So if we can green the city, rain barrels, green roofs, pervious surfaces, we could reduce the volume of water that Blue Plains would have to deal with.
Getting back to the phones, but first you, Ed Merrifield.
Right. This city was built for the federal government, and the federal government really should step up and take care of some of this problem in a big way.
Here's Tom in Manassas, Virginia. Tom, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Hi, panel. It's nice to hear from you. I really appreciate the work you do. I'm a research scientist at George Mason University, and my students have been working on looking at some of the endocrine disrupting compounds, some of the pharmaceutical, and some of the household waste products that get into the waters in our area. And I wanted to let you know how much we appreciate your efforts and let you also know that some of the data that's collected by river keepers, such as the nitrates and the pH and the temperatures and everything, have been very useful to me and my students over the years because it saves us a heck of a lot of manpower when we do these studies, and we can incorporate those studies into our work. So I just wanted to say thank you and appreciate what you're doing.
Tom, thank you for calling to say thank you. Here is Fred Tutman.
I'd like to comment on the money, because what Dottie's saying is very, very key to what's wrong with our bay and what's wrong with our rivers. It's really hard to find money to deal with a fundamental public health requirement to protect our waterways from poop, I mean, to put it bluntly. But on the other hand, if we want to build an ICC, if we want to build a bridge across the Chesapeake Bay, if we want to build a stadium on the banks of a river, people stand in line to throw money on the table in order to make that happen. We're spending billions of dollars wrecking our waterways, and we can barely find a buck 98 half the time just to pick up the problems and clean them up afterwards.
Here's Dottie.
And with the new stadium on the Anacostia River, the city is really looking to revitalize the areas along the river, so that means development. And in some places you're seeing luxury condos going in right along the waterfront. And I see a luxury condo building that has gone in right on top of a combined sewer overflow on the Anacostia. The people don't know it, but they have bought a $1 million waterfront view of their own raw sewage. And so until we deal with the combined sewer overflows, the stormwater management, you can do all the development you want on the river, but it's still not going to be a clean, safe river that's been mandated by the Clean Water Act.
I expect we'll be hearing from the developer of that condo at some point, Ed Merrifield.
Well, the larger issue would be in the 80s, we talked about $13 billion cleaning up the entire bay, and the money would get returned faster than most loans go for other large projects of any kind. And then we hear in the 1990s, and of course we didn't have the money, at least that's what we were told. In the 1990s we're hearing it's up to 20, then 30 billion, and we don't have the money. And then we hit the year 2000, 2001, and now, I mean, the number's up to about 40 billion, and we find out that we don't have the money, but we've already spent $1 trillion for one thing, $1 trillion for another. It's really sad. People have the public will, not just our political will, but the public will has to be there to make this turnaround.
This email we got from Tom in Columbia, who says, I live in Columbia, Maryland, which is near the Patuxent, and generally considers itself pretty progressive. How well is Columbia doing in being a good steward of the river?
I will be blunt that right now Howard County is the worst of our problem children in the watershed. It has tarred itself with a green brush, but it has a third-world quality sewage system. Granted, it's actually trying to raise $80 billion to build a new parallel interceptor in order to accommodate new growth. And so, on one hand, you've got a leaky system that runs through Savage, Maryland for about 12 miles, where people in that town, I can't even repeat on the air what they call the town, the people who live there, because it smelled like sewage for the last 15 years. You've got a totally disinterested political establishment that
is in Howard County
that's primarily interested in making sure that people think they invented the environment, but the truth is they haven't really done much about these fundamental problems of overflows. There's compelling evidence of unreported discharges and overflows, and a real environmental justice problem, because the people in Savage are kind of out of the main, and they're kind of downstream of the growth engine of the county. And this new sewage system that the county is trying to upgrade will accommodate enormous, fantastic growth that will further beleaguer, further urbanize the watershed. They're talking about 5,000 or 5,500 new homes, potentially, in the middle of downtown Columbia. And remember, this is a planned community. I don't know who in the world planned for this. They don't have the sewage capacity, the school capacity, the road capacity, or the market capacity. It doesn't exist.
Fred Tutman is the Patuxent Riverkeeper. He joins us in the studio along with Dottie Younger, the Anacostia Riverkeeper, and Ed Merrifield, the Potomac Riverkeeper. Here's Todd in Washington, D.C. Todd, your turn.
Hey, great to be on the show, Kojo. Always another fascinating topic. I've been spending a lot of time in Asia, and I know that the panel mentioned their travels internationally. And, you know, I'm just trying to really get my first question is, what models of success are you using? I know that in places like Singapore, they had a problem like this. Literally, they clean up their waterways, and as a small island, this is all they have in terms of fresh water in a matter of 10 to 15 years with significant political might. Where are your sources of best practices coming from at this point?
Best practices.
You know, you raise an interesting point, because I'm a guy that believes in best outcomes, and I've had government officials say to me that we didn't fail in cleaning up the bay. We just didn't have the outcome that we anticipated. That's how twisted you can get when you live in a bureaucracy. So best practices are really, really good, but only best to the extent that they have the desired outcome. So I would suggest we spend more time testing and looking at the waterway as opposed to looking at plans that on paper look really, really good but don't perform especially well in the field.
He also mentioned, Todd, our caller did, that it apparently took a significant amount of political muscle in Singapore to do that. In this case, I guess you might argue the political will seems to be lacking?
Political will is very malleable. It's expedient. You can count on an elected official, and we have many allies who are politicians, but even they have to do what is politically expedient. Cleaning up our waterways is usually not expedient. Okay, it requires a compromise. It requires a great deal of brokering. It requires getting the support from your fellow legislators and getting them in turn to support your initiatives. So much of what we see that comes through our legislatures is deeply watered down because of those compromises. It's tough.
Speaking of legislatures, Dottie Younger, earlier this week, Mayor Adrian Fenty of the District of Columbia signed a bill that will add a 5-cent fee onto paper and plastic bags used at grocery and convenience stores in the district. How will that affect the health of the river?
It'll have...
And there was a lot of objection to that bill, I might add.
There was some objection, but the outcome is going, as Fred was talking about outcomes, the outcome is going to be tremendous. Plastic bags make up almost half of the trash in the Anacostia. I mean, that's just ridiculous. In the sub-tributaries, it can make up to 70%. And we know this because folks from the Anacostia Watershed Society in particular went and walked the entire length of all of the sub-tributaries and the Anacostia and counted plastic bags. And so they took their findings and found a really great ally in Councilman Tommy Wells. And he did, and his staff did a tremendous job of going out into the communities and talking to the community about the plastic bag problem and what folks are seeing. And Anacostia Riverkeeper worked with him as well. And one of the things we did was help connect Councilman Wells with the faith community, the churches that are east of the river. These churches are right there on the river. Their members grew up in the Anacostia watershed. They learned how to swim and they learned how to fish in the Anacostia. They used to be baptized in the Anacostia River. None of those things happen now. Fishing to some extent, but without lots of fish advisories. And so the community really came together around this issue of plastic bags that we see in the river every time we're out on the river. This 5-cent user fee, I think about it like when we passed the law to wear seatbelts. It took some behavioral change on everybody's part, but it was good for us to wear our seatbelts. It's good for us to carry cloth bags instead of counting on paper and plastic bags. And it's always been this myth that the plastic and paper bags we get are free. They're not really free. They're factored in the cost when we shop. And also the amount of money that we pay in taxes to clean up the plastic bags from the river. So it's this myth that there's been this free bag. And the district is going to work very hard to get cloth bags to the elderly and to low-income folks. District Department of the Environment is going to make available 100,000 free bags. And so it really has been a great success story of the community coming together with politicians to address a particular, specific problem that's affecting the Anacostia and that can really engender a change in the river.
And your own knowledge of and interest in the role played by the faith community in pushing for a cleanup of the Anacostia River is informed by your personal life. You're studying to be an ordained minister.
I am, yes.
On to you, Ed Merrifield.
Well, just to add to that, in the Anacostia, well, the Water and Sewer Authority tells us that about 100 tons every month of trash is removed, even at this time, from the Potomac and the Anacostia. And every day, 23 tons of trash is removed from the catch basins. So that there's just a lot of work to be done there. One other thing that Fred, the last caller, had to say, I'd like to just say that one of the great laws in America is the Clean Water Act, even if we're not following it completely. And that is something that I think other parts of the world need to look at, is to have a great law like that.
And Todd, thank you for your call. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with three of our region's river keepers on the Patuxent, Anacostia, and Potomac rivers, and take your calls. If you called, stay on the line. We'll try to get to your call as quickly as possible. If the lines are busy, send an email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. This is WAMU 88.5. I'm Matt Bush.
Coming up at 1, celebrating a new beginning after a significant election in the Middle East. Plus, it's opera like you've never heard it before. We get a live in-studio performance today at 1 on The Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's presentation of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, tonight at 8 at the Music Center at Strathmore. The film noir classic will be shown with the original voice track, while the BSO performs Bernard Herrmann's cinematic score. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar.
In this country, Michael Jackson's Ever Lightning Skin caused much comment over the years. In other parts of the world, lightning dark skin is big business.
Be the one with Active White Skin. Active White L-glutathione capsules.
How people of color around the world are being sold on the appeal of pale skin. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's on Tell Me More at 2 here on WAMU 88.5.
Partly cloudy skies today. The high will get up to 81 degrees overnight, mostly cloudy with a low of 65 degrees, and then tomorrow sunny with a high of 83. Currently it's 79 in northwest D.C. Now back to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
We're talking with Ed Merrifield. He is the Potomac River Keeper. Dottie Younger is the Anacostia River Keeper. And Fred Tutman is the Patuxent River Keeper. Fred, you're the only African-American water keeper in our region. To what extent are people of color engaged or disengaged in these issues, and what do you do to reach out to them?
Well, the communities that are adversely affected by the issues we work on are very engaged. And I think in my organization, we're especially proactive to work on these communities that are underserved, which doesn't just include people of color. It includes people who are impoverished or people who have been disenfranchised for various reasons. That is, I think, the essence of our economic system that also has to be addressed if we're going to deal with these pollution problems. We're busy moving these effects from one community to enrich another, and we're denuding certain communities of their natural resources or their sense of place, things that are of great precious value. I can tell you your environmental quality based on your zip code, because in our economy, in our society, these things like clean water and clean air, they're commodities, and that's wrong. They're being privatized to enrich folks, which in turn strips value, impoverishes other communities.
Dottie Younger, how do these environmental justice issues play into the health of the Anacostia River?
Well, I'll give you a good example. Anacostia National Park at Poplar Point. That was created by the Olmsted Act back in the late 1800s. And Poplar Point was created to be the east of the river equivalent of Rock Creek Park. If you've been to Anacostia National Park lately, you can very quickly deduce that it is not anywhere near the equivalent of Rock Creek Park. And government agencies for years have used Poplar Point as their own property. It's a national parkland, but yet they have had motor garages there. They have dumped their topsoil there. They have left a legacy of arsenic and mercury, for example, and then dispensed the area off. And so you have contaminated soil. You have contamination at Poplar Point with kids playing right next door. And when it rains, again, those contaminants are being carried into the Anacostia River. The city is now very interested in restoring Anacostia National Park, but they are interested in restoring it to a soccer stadium and mixed development use. And as Fred is talking about, the folks there are being robbed of their park. And we would never have the conversation about putting in a soccer stadium at Rock Creek Park that we are having about Anacostia National Park. This is where these environmental justice issues are so critical, and that's where a riverkeeper like myself, and also someone studying to be an ordained minister, environmental justice is where the faith community and the environmental community, it's where they overlap. It's where they come together. And so Anacostia Riverkeeper wants to see Poplar Point cleaned up and restored to being the 110-acre park that it was meant to be. That still leaves 40 acres just adjacent to the park for mixed-use development. So the community can have both their park and the development their community needs. It doesn't need to be one or the other. The community can have both. And anybody who tells them it's one or the other is lying to them or is looking to make money from it.
As Fred Tutman has been pointing out consistently on this broadcast, here's Dina in Great Falls, Virginia. Dina, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm so happy you're having this topic. I'm in Great Falls in a water advisory group through Fairfax County. And just as an aside, Virginia was, the farmers especially, were trying to vote against having plastic bags because they said it fouled up the farm machinery, which is kind of an interesting turn of events. But it got voted down. But my question is about this latest issue about Merck, where they loosened the requirement, the restrictions on their pollutants. And also I wanted to inquire about the state of Virginia, where the landscapers are pretty much unregulated on how much pollutants and pesticides, herbicides, whatever they can use. And I wanted to know how the riverkeepers and what's happening in that area to try to appeal to the state on those issues.
Here's Ed Merrifield.
Well, regarding Merck, I believe Chesapeake Bay Foundation has picked up on this. They asked, I think they're challenging the permit as it stands right now. The permit has to do with where they're going to get their credits if Merck is allowed to do what they want to do. And right now it's just in the early stages of the permit and the challenge, so we'll have to wait and see how that goes.
Thank you for your call, Dina. Here's David in Silver Spring, Maryland. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kojo, and thanks to the Riverkeepers. I wanted to talk about and get your opinion on the idea of really trying to mainstream this type of information. I hear you talking about, you know, getting public will, understanding the economic impacts, both to the public and the political side. But, oops, sorry about that. A different phone going off. What I wanted to bring up is people's contact with the environment comes from things on a daily basis, like you got just before your, at the last break, a weather report. And you talk about the cause of this being things like river and storm runoff. Is there advocacy, is there discussion to really bring this into that same kind of information so that when someone gets, you know, it's going to rain today and tomorrow you're going to see your river turn orange. And the impact on this is your water quality on a regular and routine basis so that we don't just get, hey, it's going to rain, but we really start to get that full environmental impact on us so people can say and see the improvements and see this issue of the outcomes, but from a routine mainstreaming of this information, not kind of ad hoc training here, a chance to talk on Kojo's show, like every hour on the hour.
You mean not just how it's going to affect your morning or evening commute? You want more information than that in your weather forecast, David? You want to also know how it's likely to affect the rivers and the pollution in the rivers?
Well, I wanted to hear my weather report. My weather report will say this afternoon there's going to be a thunderstorm, and subsequent to that, the river flow, and maybe there's a river flood warning. And by the way, the next stage of that forecast is the next 3 days we're going to see high contaminant of the Anacostia, and next week we're going to see this impacting algal blooms in the Chesapeake.
I don't know how riverkeepers feel. I feel it's a good idea, but of course nobody's offered me a job as a weather forecaster anyplace recently.
Yeah, this is key. What water keepers are able to do, because we all run relatively small organizations, we have to do what we can do. And what we can do is to incite communities and others to action, and that gets to messaging. And what you're talking about is the kind of messaging that resonates with you. But I got to be honest with you, and scientists are not going to like this. I can't sell science nearly as well as I can sell the spiritual connection that most people have to the idea of clean water and stewardship and connection to the great outdoors. Science is important, there's absolutely no question. But the bigger message that I can move to a wider and incite more people to action has to do with restoring that connection that people have lost.
Ed Merrifield?
Well, it seems to me over the years that the way I get people's attention, if it isn't their issue, is to talk to their money, their health, or their kids. And I think there's a health issue here that we all have to pay attention to over time.
Here's an email we got from Jessica in Tacoma Park, Maryland. My husband thinks it's safe for our son to wade into Sligo Creek near our house. Are the rivers in this area generally clean enough to wade in? And does this cause further environmental problems for the river?
Historically, actually, Sligo Creek has had problems. There are discharges that have occurred previously. In fact, Friends of Sligo Creek is a party to a consent decree with Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission over rusty pipes, ancient infrastructure, basically water supply problems, water quality problems that need to be addressed. So I don't know if I could give you a boilerplate answer. Is it safe or isn't it? But there have been problems on Sligo Creek, no question.
Here now, Susie in Washington, D.C. Susie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Susie Brunninga. I work for the National Association of Clean Water Agencies,
yeah.
And we deal with a lot of these issues. And I just wanted to address the funding issue very briefly. When you raised the issue about the consent decree that D.C. WASA was engaged in and the billions of dollars, that just is not something that is just happening in Washington, D.C. It's all over our country. And we agree that funding is a critical component of helping us achieve our clean water goals. And we are working toward establishing a clean water trust fund. And this show is very timely. Just last week, the Government Accountability Office issued a report estimating a national funding gap of $150 billion to $400 billion over the next decade to address clean water infrastructure. And next week, Representative Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat from Oregon, is going to introduce trust fund legislation so that we can establish a trust fund. We think that the trust fund will generate about $10 billion annually to help cities pay to fix their infrastructure, to fix their CSOs. And our belief is that we have trust funds for highways and airports, and we think that we should also have trust fund to ensure we have clean water.
Susie, thank you for your call, and I'm sure that our listeners really value that kind of information. Here now is Chris in Washington, D.C. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I am involved in the local community farmers markets here, and I make crab cakes. And what I have been trying to do is save some money to purchase a boat to actually start a small nonprofit getting kids out in the community, cleaning up the Anacostia River and giving them more a visceral connection with the way the waters flow and the Chesapeake Bay and everything else. And I'm wondering how, whom I can get in touch with to get this started. I've already bought the boat. I just need the kids for a after-school program, something like that.
Well, Donnie Younger said depends on how good your crab cakes are. But here's
look at Washingtonian's Best of this month.
here's Donnie Younger.
I was actually just thinking about the crab cakes. Coach, you read my mind there. Right. All of the Riverkeeper programs are started like you're starting. We start as small nonprofits. We get a boat, and we have a person, and you go out and you engage with your community. There's got to be local schools that are nearby to where you are. I would just go in and introduce yourself to the principal, or if there are community organizations that would like to go out on the river, I go and introduce yourself to those. I mean, we go around and talk to garden clubs and whatnot to get our message out and to let people know about
Speaking
us.
Speaking of which, if I may interrupt, here's this email we got from Brian in Annapolis, Chris. Brian says, I'm very pleased that you're hosting this conversation with the river keepers. They are an overlooked, valuable resource that I believe should have more exposure to the public. Can you ask them to talk about the community activities that they run every year to bring people together and in touch with the river systems and the problems that they face? The Patuxent River Sojourn is a great yearly trip that I participate in every year. Fred Tutman is my hero.
Wow.
Says Brian from Annapolis. So that's the kind. Those are the kinds of. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, yeah. All of us, each of us, have websites, and we all have a lot going on under the hood. So I'd encourage you, if you have a polarization to all of our or India,
and we'll provide
watersheds.
A link to all of your websites at our website, kojoshow.org, so you'll be able to find out more about what each one of the Patuxent, Anacostia, and Potomac River keepers are doing, Chris, and. Dottie says, hold her a crab cake.
Can I ask one quick question? I just want to know, what about the liability issues of going into schools and getting kids? That's really a major concern, because when I proposed this to my insurance company, they kind of flew off the handle.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if I have a good handle on that, and I think it's very laudable to want to educate and engage school kids. As long as we're also educating them about how to file Freedom of Information Act requests and educating them about the First Amendment and showing them how to be advocates. You know, my favorite moment with a 9-year-old girl was when she got up out of her chair and she said, that plant down the river for me, they're going down, buddy. And that was much more powerful for me than, you know, just taking out people for excursions.
I'm afraid we're just about out of time, but Ed Merrifield, if we were to have this conversation again a decade from now, what changes would you hope to see in terms of the health of your river?
Well, we can define it from above and below the fall line here in D.C. Above, we want to have the water so clean that right down in this area, we know we're getting the cleanest and safest drinking water. And that really depends on the health of our rivers and streams. And the same thing really is true for below. We just need cleaner and healthier rivers and streams.
Ed Merrifield is the Potomac River Keeper. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dottie Younger is the Anacostia River Keeper. Thank you for joining us. Good luck getting a good crab cake from Chris.
Thank you.
Fred Tutman is the Patuxent River Keeper. Fred, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the time, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. Now, go out there and do something. I'm Kojo Nandi.